everybody. Hope you had a wonderful day today. Get ready for 3 hours of always entertaining, informative, and sometimes illuminating. Well, we hope more than sometimes. Radio and discussion and conversation with some of the most important and always interesting people of our times. There's a book out that deals with something that I have been talking about along with many of my guests over the years, directly, indirectly, and pretty much on the periphery, but we have talked about it. And that's the concept that there has been some kind of an ongoing influence on the planet from extraterrestrial visitors for a long time. Now, a book is out which details this very thesis in great articulation and intellect. It's a marvelous book by Michael E. Salla, S-A-L-L-A. He's a Ph.D. We won't call him doctor, but that is something he could do if he'd like. He prefers to be called Michael. And let me just read a little quick blurb from the book, which is entitled very deftly, Exopolitics. I like that. Michael Salla presents an astounding and eyebrow-raising alternative history of the past 100 years. He postulates that since at least the 1930s, every major war and policy decision has been in response to an undisclosed extraterrestrial presence on Earth. To one degree or another. He traces actual events ranging from the Nazi development of flying saucers to the recent U.S. invasion of Iraq to this unworldly element within government and societal issues. Salla's case could be easily dismissed as fringe conspiracy theory, except that it is well supported by the data, answers many of the recent history's most perplexing mysteries and questions, and with each passing year, is gaining credence with thinkers all around the globe. Read and contemplate that thesis today, tomorrow. It may be the news headlines of the near future. That's from Jim Mars, our buddy, who, of course, wrote Rule by Secrecy and Alien Agenda. Let's welcome our guest now, Michael Salla, to the program. Hello there. Are you there?
Yes. Hi. Thank you, Jeff.
That's pretty much a masterstroke, that book of yours. You have taken an issue that has, as I've said, been lurking in the shadows for a long time. People have tossed it out, and certainly one of the easiest conspiracy theories to throw away is that there are ETs on the planet interacting, engaged with, and directing and influencing the human condition. People would just throw that one out, I think, as quickly as any, and maybe even quicker. But you've put some real interesting data together in the book. What got you interested in this, Michael, and how long did the book take to produce?
Well, I'm very interested in the political side of the whole extraterrestrial question. I mean, my background is in politics, and in particular international politics and international conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very interested in what the extraterrestrial question meant in terms of the way international conflict has played out over the years. And what I discerned in my own studies of international conflict was that there were patterns there, and patterns that indicated that there were deeper causes for these conflicts than the ones that we were teaching about and researching at the universities that I've worked at in the past.
Right.
And so that really took me on a journey to looking for answers, and I ended up with the extraterrestrial presence.
Patterns. We'll get back to that in a minute. Have you had any personal sightings in your life of unusual events that you couldn't explain?
No, not nothing that sparked this. I mean, really, it was just out of my interest in what it is that's driving international conflict. And I think in terms of a kind of underlying belief system,
mm-hmm.
Well, very early on in life, I've always had a belief that extraterrestrials were very much a part of life, or at least something to be looked at, but like anyone that contemplating any kind of professional career, it was something you just kind of left in the background there, and you just went off and did your thing and forgot about it.
You don't put that under hobbies on your resume.
That's right. I remember putting tennis in my resume, but not ETs.
You know, the issue of intelligent life, not only visiting here, but certainly interacting with humans, is one that probably, it may be the most important of all when it comes to contemplating ET and contact with the human species. Now, I always go back to that great, and I call it a geopolitical sci-fi thriller, the film The Day the Earth Stood Still, 1951, directed by Robert Wise, which remains a classic and always will be. And in my humble estimation, that is probably that scenario about the only chance this planet really has to extract itself somehow from the hands of evil and greed and almost a death wish, if you will. Our species is not taking care of our home, and the home will be destroyed sooner or later. So when you go back to that film, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and look at the political implications of an ultimatum to the planet from an off-planet intelligence and how it works out, it's very enlightening. And I think just for my two cents, it kind of fits in with your overall concept of interaction here.
Yes, I remember watching that many, many years ago, and it made a deep impression because I think there's a deep truth in that something that people resonate with at some level, that there's a life out there that's more advanced than ours, and they must look at us and, you know, they must ask questions about, well, is there intelligent life on Earth?
Well, I'm still asking that question myself.
Yes, they're probably waiting for us to display a certain level of maturity before they basically turn on the lights and say, well, you know, we're here, and these are questions that you need to look at now.
I think they're going to have a long wait unless they come in and lay down the law. I just don't see it. We have given over to greed and the dark side now. There are wonderful people on the planet, but unfortunately their destiny is all too often controlled by those who are not wonderful people. Now, patterns. What? Tell us a little bit about your historical background and studies that maybe alerted you to see patterns here.
Well, one study that I did was looking at the U.S. foreign policy in terms of patterns in that, in terms of how it goes through different cycles of highs and lows, and historically over the 200 years that, well, 200 plus years that America's been an independent nation, there are patterns in foreign policy. So that's the sort of interest that I have in history and foreign policy. So I was looking for something similar to help me understand, well, what is happening now with this ET presence.
Okay, give us some examples of patterns and events which caught your attention. Routines. Obviously, there are things that must have happened somewhat repetitively to give you an idea that there was a thread here.
Sure, yeah. Well, one of the things that really got me thinking about deeper causes to conflicts were the... after the end of the Cold War, you had a lot of conflicts that looked to be very intractable suddenly on the verge of being resolved. You had the Northern Ireland conflict. You had Israel-Palestine.
That's no longer looking very good, but I understand the point.
Yes, those conflicts looked as though they were about to be solved, and you had peace agreements. And then they began to unravel.
Quickly.
It was like you had this promising burst of initiatives after the Cold War ended where it looked as though, well, you know, we're finally starting to resolve these intractable international conflicts. And then they just collapsed, and then you had a return to kind of that pattern of violent conflict. And that really got me thinking that, well, there's something else here that, why is it that these conflicts look as though they might be resolved through peaceful means, and then after a lot of well-intentioned people try to do these peace initiatives, then things begin to unravel again. So it was as though there was a force that wanted these conflicts to continue, that in fact the international system is based on some underlying forces that rely on international conflict as a cover for whatever it is that's being hidden.
Certainly also as a not too clever cover for profit.
Well, that's a very important part of the whole thing. And hopefully I'll be able to spend a little time just talking about how that whole international system is financed so that the ET presence can be pursued and developed by those organizations that have been monopolizing the knowledge and the technology that's been gained from the extraterrestrial presence.
What was it about 70 years ago that triggered this the modern interpretation of potential influence?
Well, I mean, there was this very interesting situation where in the 1930s, the only country on the planet that really was open to this whole idea of an extraterrestrial presence was, funnily enough, Nazi Germany.
Right.
And that was because Adolf Hitler and the people within his Nazi party were really fascinated by the occult, and they took seriously the claims by those who were arguing that they could communicate telepathically with life on other worlds. And so when people from the various secret societies that the Nazis were sponsoring came forward and said, well, that they were in touch with extraterrestrials, the Nazis took this seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what they discovered was a gold mine of technology and information that really gave them this incredible burst of knowledge that helped them fuel their war goals. And,
well, yes, that certainly, and Wall Street money as well helped them. But yes, a gold mine of knowledge, certainly a gold mine of vision of the whole cosmic realm of things. And we'll pause on that. We'll come right back with Michael Sala and talk a little bit more about Nazi Germany and their fascination with the occult, which certainly included E.T., and how little of all of that we really have access to. It has clearly been kept put away from us. All of the interest that the Nazis had in this field has not been exactly available in a bestseller. But it was huge. A major amount of material remains to be unearthed. Hold on, and we'll be right back. Okay, welcome back. Talking with Michael Sala, his book, Exopolitics. Fascinating book. All right, now, the amount of data that we have been able to freely and easily access that was confiscated in the ruins of Nazi Germany is relatively small, Michael. Were you able to pull together any more? Were you able to get hold of material that otherwise isn't easy to do? And I would expect you would agree with me that an awful lot is not known about all of that interest and what they did find out.
Yes, certainly, Jeff. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of information that they pulled out of Nazi Germany that is being kept secret. And we really won't know the full story other than the isolated reports that did emerge from those that commented on the remarkable technology that Nazi Germany had developed that was far in advance of what the West possessed. And certainly... I haven't been able to find anything new than what others have commented on, but certainly it did suggest what I did find was that the Nazis had some help, some external help in terms of developing their technology.
Now, at the end of the war, it's not known, but the Germans were working on, let me try and remember, I don't have the accurate number. The exact number, but it was close to 100 different kinds of missiles Many of them were ground-to-air, well, they were surface-to-air missiles is what they were. They would have taken down fleets of bombers and all the rest of it. Another 6 months and the whole war would have changed. That's not to say that the Germans were, in fact, successful or about to be successful in developing nuclear weapons. In point of fact, Berlin may have been hit with the atomic bomb like Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But they were really advanced, and one has to ask him or herself the obvious question, how did they get so advanced? Are the Germans just that more intelligent, creative, scientifically inspired, brilliant, disciplined? What was it about Germany, Michael Sal, that put them in such a position? And your answer is partially already answered.
Well, I mean, certainly they had an industrial capacity that was first rate. I mean, they were able to manufacture a range of technologies that would be deployed for the war effort. But I think in terms of the advanced technologies like the bombers or the missiles, and also the reports of saucer-like aircraft,
right,
that they had some help. And I think the help that they had was one that you can get an idea from in terms of those early communications that the Nazi secret societies claimed to have initiated with extraterrestrial races, either from other worlds or from subterranean worlds. And I think that what they discovered were secrets that these extraterrestrials had in the past cooperated with other civilizations, and that some technology was buried. And I think that is why the Nazis sponsored expeditions to South America, Egypt, Tibet, and to Antarctica to find these extraterrestrial artifacts.
Were they successful?
I believe so. I believe that they were successful enough to be able to get an understanding of the extraterrestrial technologies, and I'm pretty sure that as far as developing an extraterrestrial ship, something, well, what we call a flying saucer, something that was
right,
able to move at speeds that really would just far exceed anything that the Allies had, that the Nazis had gone quite some distance in achieving that, and that in fact they may have taken much of that technology with them at the end of the war.
Maybe to South America. Maybe to Antarctica. We don't know. Also, of course, right at the end of the war, ordered into full production, but time ran out, was the HO-229 that Goering wanted, a twin-jet bat-winged interceptor, single seat, which could fly in excess of 600 miles an hour and was radar evading. We've done stories on that, too. So, truly prodigious accomplishments. And we'll be right back with Michael Sala in just a few minutes. Okay, we're talking with Michael Sala. I'm Jeff Rentz. If you're new to the program, that's R-E-N-S-E. Michael Sala, Ph.D., his book, Exopolitics, Political Implications of Extraterrestrial Presence. So, the Germans in World War II, boy, would that be a story if it could really be told, and their so-called occult, meaning secret, dealings, discoveries, and implementations. Certainly, they may not have picked up pieces of hardware, but it would suggest, I think, if I'm reading you right, that their ideas and concepts may have been enhanced tremendously, either by direct contact or by discoveries of things. We call it back engineering now.
That's correct, yes. I mean, they were given some important pointers by whatever communications they could establish with extraterrestrials. And I think that they were led to different places on the planet to find technologies that were left there by ancient civilizations. In particular, there are many stories about the Vimanas in ancient India.
Sure.
And there were places that I'm sure that the technology, that this was held in some safe places, and the Nazis were probably successful in finding some of this and taking that back to them, back to Nazi Germany to develop their own versions.
Interesting how they allegedly made a wrong turn during the development of their atomic weapons program, or they would have had it before the West. Well, I mean the West, the U.S.
Well, that's true. I think it was possibly due to Hitler's desire to develop technologies that were consistent with some pre-existing natural order.
Something that he understood, being a World War I veteran, the more eclectic material would have probably not been as accessible to him. When you think back of how he really bungled the Messerschmitt 262 program, he could have had that jet operational as an air superiority fighter 2 years earlier than it finally went into service, and it took General of the Fighter Forces Adolf Galland and most of the top aces threat that they were going to quit before Hitler gave up his plans to make it a bomber. He wanted to be able to go over and bomb England with it and then race home without being interfered with. He didn't understand the concept of air superiority. So what you're saying makes sense, that the more unusual and fanciful kinds of technology would have been given less priority, perhaps.
Yes, I think he made some pretty major strategic errors in his strategies, and I guess that's very fortunate for all of us. Otherwise, we'd probably be speaking in German now.
Hard to know. You know, I've spent decades studying this, and what usually happens in extremist regimes that we watched with the Soviet Union and others is the strong man goes down, his successor is more moderate, and quite often there is a mitigation of much of the evil in these things. And ultimately the Soviet Union, evil as it was, consumed itself and fell apart. So maybe we wouldn't be speaking German, but the world would have been a much different place, there's no question about it.
Yes, definitely. Thankfully, we don't have to live with reality of the
Nazi
Germany.
Of course, Hitler did not want to invade England. He respected the English, and because of the intermarriages over the centuries and all of the rest of it, that was another error. I saw a documentary once, fascinating, called How Hitler Lost the War, and it made some three or four very key points, which his generals would have advised otherwise, but when you're El Supremo, nobody goes against the grain too much. Okay, now, there's something I want to ask you about. Let's move past World War II. We may not leave it, but going up to 1947, was it 1947 that Admiral Byrd took that that very large task force to the Antarctic?
Yes, it was 1946-1947, where he took 4,600 sailors with him to Antarctica for an expedition that would basically claim the continent for the United States.
They didn't go down to look for penguins.
Well, they certainly went there for purposes that I think were not disclosed to the general public.
And still haven't been.
Well, yes, definitely. I think what happened down there has been kept a secret. Limited interviews that Admiral Byrd gave after the expedition down there ended prematurely indicated that they had suffered some casualties and that there was a new threat that was able to travel from pole to pole very, very quickly, and that the rest of the planet needed to face up to this.
See, now that excuse me, but that's a really important point, and many of our listeners don't know much about this, if anything. That this very large task force went down there under Admiral Byrd and came back as Michael just said, prematurely after suffering losses. Now, that's 1946, 47. Not too many years later, General MacArthur made his very famous statement about the next enemy we face may be from another world. Basically, I'm paraphrasing. So it would seem that at the highest levels there was some knowledge of what happened in the Antarctic. That's not an irrational thing to presuppose, I don't think.
Yes, I think, within the military circles, that knowledge of these different threats or these exotic threats would have been known, at least with the senior leaders, people in charge of the various commands, and MacArthur would have been in charge of that Pacific theater. And so there would have been some knowledge on his part on exactly what it was that was a threat, and the extraterrestrial presence was part of that.
Indeed it was. And remember, in 1948, 49, we're into the very, very heavy sightings all over the world, especially North America, of UFOs of many different types by literally hundreds of thousands of people, thousands of newspaper stories. It was an age of great awareness and, I suspect, great fear on the part of many in government, not only this one, but others as well. Hold on, we'll be right back with Michael Sala, Ph.D., and his book, X, which is truly taking a look ahead by virtue of examining the past. Okay, welcome back. Talking with Michael Sala about his book, Exopolitics. Okay, Michael, anything else about World War II you want to look at and we'll move forward that rang your bell?
I think we've covered most of that.
Okay, next on the list, Korea. Did the Korean War have anything that bothered you? We had that whole epoch again from 1948 to 52, which was, I think, the very peak of the UFO years. Certainly, if they weren't the peak years, they were close to it.
Well, that's right. We did have those sightings waves throughout the latter part of the 1940s, and I'm sure that they would have been indicative of a heightened interest by ETs of what was happening on the planet. And it just seems from the historical records that ETs have been interested in wars. They've been interested in what humans do during these wars and the behavior of the various sides. And so I think the Korean War would have been an example of this. And certainly MacArthur would have been aware of whatever sightings were made. And I think that was probably part of the background knowledge that he had that informed his later comments about humanity having to bind together to fight against an external threat.
Right. If any of you ever want to go newspaper archive digging, I'm sure, Michael, you did, in the months before Roswell, as an example, the newspapers were loaded with sightings all over the country.
Yes, that's right. June of 47 was when you did have a wave of sightings, and they were so pronounced that the Air Force actually started up an investigation of these sightings, and that investigation led to a preliminary report out of the Pentagon, and the official in charge, Colonel George Garrett, produced a report saying that not only was the flying saucer phenomenon something real and something that couldn't be dismissed, but he also, and this I thought was very significant, was that he said that, you know, because there was a lack of interest in the flying saucer phenomenon by the top brass at the Pentagon, that he suspected that they knew the answer to whether or not these were extraterrestrial in origin, and whether that they were real, of course. So, I mean, he put that in his report that was circulated in August of 1947, and eventually that led to the project sign getting underway in December of 47.
Right. Okay. All right. Bring us forward with your book now. Give me a couple of other areas of particular interest you want to talk about.
Sure. Well, I think what is significant is that that early period in 47, decisions were made about what to reveal to the general public. I think that the Air Force conducted these investigations, which seemed to indicate that while at the official level, people were still trying to work out whether this phenomenon was real. But I think that the response to the early reports and the very first major report, which was the Project Sign report that began in December 47 and that was released and sent all the way up to the chief of the Air Force, that's General Hoyt Vandenberg, in September of 1948.
Mm-hmm.
That report actually came up with a conclusive finding that the extraterrestrial presence was what was behind these flying saucer sightings. And what happened was that that report was basically rejected. All copies were burned or, well, were destroyed.
Huh.
And a new diluted report was substituted a couple of months later, which was, again, an inconclusive report. But essentially what happened was that General Vandenberg was saying to his own intelligence officials out at Patterson Air Force Base that
mm-hmm.
they couldn't come up with a conclusive answer to the extraterrestrial phenomenon, that what they were supposed to do was conduct investigations that would be inconclusive, but they couldn't come up with a conclusive finding. So in other words, a cover-up was underway.
Already, sure. Well, Vandenberg was, I guess, one of the original members of MJ-12.
That's correct. I think he would have played a prominent role in that early management system that was set up to deal with the extraterrestrial presence.
It's interesting, isn't it, how America's second spaceport, if you will, Vandenberg Air Force Base, was named after a man who really wasn't the holder of one of the most famous names in American military history. And yet the role he played obviously was enormous in the area of reaching out into space.
Yes, definitely. He was the person that really did make some key decisions about what was to be released to the public. Now, one can always speculate as to whether or not Vandenberg himself was under instructions. I mean, we did have a Project Majestic 12 system set up where Truman basically organized for key cabinet and defense and science officials to meet to discuss these extraterrestrial questions. And one of the first ones that they would have dealt with was, well, how much do they tell the general public and how much do they tell Congress? And I think in both accounts, they basically decided nothing. That the public and Congress had to be kept out of the loop and basically kept under the perception that the extraterrestrial presence was something that wasn't conclusive. That,
well, yeah, next to the Flat Earth Society, that was the second dumbest thing that you could offer to an otherwise intelligent populace.
Well, that's right. I think many suspected the truth, and many worked very hard for it, and
and still are, and here we are, at, what, how many years later? And there's, the government is still playing. He'd say the government, it's not the people that sit in the halls of Congress. They're clueless as well. It's the power structure that actually runs the country. And here's a story from the BBC. You're British. And
Australian.
This is close, close.
Yes.
They
have the same queen.
That's right. Well, cousins. The BBC, David Derbyshire, is a very good writer, and this is just another story. One in 20 stars in the night sky could be orbited by Earth-like planets capable of supporting life. One out of 20. Now, that, as each month and each year goes by, these estimates increase. Within 10 years, telescopes should be powerful enough to detect those kinds of planets directly and reveal whether their atmosphere contains traces of life. So we're getting better and better. So, yeah, the whole idea of we're the center of the universe in terms of life and all the rest of it is ludicrous. Okay, we're up to the 1950s now. Tell me more about the book, though, and some of the things you point to.
Well, in the book, what I start off in doing is to really describe the management system that was set up, that the extraterrestrial presence was something that was realized to be in existence very early on in the piece, and the national security system was amended organized in a way to deal with this, that it wasn't a matter of, okay, extraterrestrials are real, let's keep it quiet from the public and not tell Congress and let's just kind of like continue to do investigations. Well, no, you needed to set up a national security apparatus to interface with the extraterrestrials. You needed to set up a compartmentalized system of black operations that had to be top secret, where even the rank and file in the military wouldn't know what was going on. You needed to set up a funding system so that these projects could be funded in a way where there wouldn't be any congressional oversight or any understanding by Congress that appropriations were being used for funding projects that were dealing with ETs.
And that was pretty much the birth of a lot of the black operations programs.
Exactly. And I think what you had was something that surpassed the Manhattan Project. The original Manhattan Project, I mean, we have to understand that it was set up to produce an atomic bomb, but it was done under the with the knowledge of Congress that while those monies were going to be used, those appropriations that Congress gave to the defense were going to be used for projects that would help win the war. Well, with the extraterrestrial issue, what you had was something different. Here, Congress wasn't aware of what any money would be used for, and that, in fact, there was a separate system, a separate funding system set up outside of the regular appropriations process to raise funding for these black operations. And I think over the years, this has increased. So we've had the development of a vast black budget that far surpasses the estimates that many others have come up with for how big this is.
And the old proverb that I like to, well, I think I made it up, but how much money do the black ops programs get? As much as they need.
Yes, and the thing is that it was all legal, because in 1949 you had the passage of the CIA Act, which was an amendment to the National Security Act of 1947. And with the CIA Act, basically you had a funding system set up for the CIA, which meant that they could raise funds outside of the law. That in fact, that they weren't limited in any way by law in how they raised funds from various appropriations, and so that really did give the CIA an extraordinary ability to raise funding in ways that people just wouldn't have suspected possible.
And a lot of that drug money, folks, may well be going into these black ops programs. It's just an unlimited supply. All right. Be back and talk a little bit more with Michael Sala about his book, Exopolitics, in just a few minutes. Are ETs involved with some of the major events on this planet? Are ETs actually on the planet walking around, perhaps unrecognizable, influencing events? Are they in contact with some of our world leaders, telling them what to do, how to do it? What about all this evil on the planet all of a sudden that seemingly is strangling the life out of the Earth itself? What are they up to? Who are they loyal to? Who's talking to them? And many, many questions like that, talking with our guest Michael Sala, are answered in his book, or at least speculated upon in the book, Exopolitics, Political Implications of Extraterrestrial Presence on the Planet. Do we actually think, Michael, that there may be some people who might even be on the news from time to time who are not necessarily one of us?
Well, that would be an interesting possibility. Some of the news announcers, you mean, whether they...
Well, not only the news announcers, but some of those talking heads. Maybe some of our world leaders. You know, it's been postulated that that's certainly a possibility.
Well, you know, I think there are many ways in which leaders can be related to or controlled by extraterrestrial races, and one of those may in fact be a form of control or where the leader becomes a kind of asset unknowingly, where they really take positions that do further the agenda of a particular group. So, there may be that happening.
Right. If what we know about abductions and mind control and how people can be given screen memories and influence and so on and so forth are true, certainly the control of some of the key players in the world geopolitical stage, on the world geopolitical stage, could be a very easily accomplished thing by an advanced race. I don't see why it wouldn't be.
Yes, I think that there has been a lot of work done in developing various mind control technologies by national security agencies that are based on what they've learned from extraterrestrial mind control techniques.
Now, have they been, Michael, in your opinion, have they been taught, or have they found it through other means, or both?
Well, I believe that there's a lot of evidence to support the conclusion that an agreement was reached between the Eisenhower administration and extraterrestrial races, and that part of this agreement involved the exchange of technologies for basing rights and for the abduction of civilians for alien projects.
Right. That would have been 1954, the meeting at Edwards Air Force Base.
That's correct, yes. That was a very significant meeting because it represented a major development, because up until that time what you had were a lot of sightings or communications with extraterrestrials. In 1954, this was the first clear evidence that I had found in my own research that there was an actual diplomatic meeting between extraterrestrials and a human government, and that this resulted in a number of meetings where eventually an agreement was set up with one group of extraterrestrials known as the Tall Greys, and that this really did set in place a process by which civilians would become part of the abduction program.
What evidence did you find that the Eisenhower meeting took place? We've seen little bits and pieces of it. He was, as I believe I remember, allegedly in Palm Springs. And wasn't that it? Wasn't he in Palm Springs? And he was supposedly gone to the dentist or something like that, and actually he was zipped over to meet Ed Edwards?
That's right, yes. I mean, there was a cover story used that he had gone to the dentist. Now, the problem with the cover story was that what was subsequently found out was that, well, the dentist had no medical record of Eisenhower being treated, and also the Eisenhower Library had no record of an acknowledgement card being sent to the dentist to thank him for the treatment. Now, that was very unusual because acknowledgement cards were sent out for all sorts of things. You know, people who had provided flowers, who had organized the meals, that anyone that had performed any kind of service during that trip was sent a card, but yet there was nothing sent to this particular dentist. And the dentist himself never actually admitted that he had treated Eisenhower.
Right.
Throughout the rest of his life, all he had to say was no comment when asked about what happened. So I believe that that is evidence that what you have is a cover story there.
Sure.
And what Eisenhower did that night was something else, and I think that there's a lot of evidence that he in fact traveled to Edwards Air Force Base for a meeting with extraterrestrials who landed there in what's been described as five ships, and that they had a meeting that was discussing how important it was for the extraterrestrials for the Eisenhower administration to put a stop to the nuclear development program that they had had underway. What was significant in that meeting was that it was held less than 2 weeks before the biggest test of a hydrogen bomb by the Eisenhower administration to date. That was called the Big Mike, that particular test at Bikini Atoll in the South Pacific. And so what you have there is a relationship between what the extraterrestrials were requesting of the Eisenhower administration with an event shortly afterwards, which would suggest that, it was logical that the extraterrestrials were worried about this nuclear testing because they knew what was in the pipeline.
Well, it sure did slow down the development, didn't it?
Well,
it didn't, obviously. The whole Cold War and the nuclear arms race went on unabated. At least it would appear so.
Well, yes, there was a decision taken to really continue with this full-scale development of nuclear weapons and to continue in the Cold War. And the race in particular that was part of that meeting, no agreement was reached with those, but another race of extraterrestrials did meet subsequently, and there was agreement with those, and of course they're the ubiquitous greys that the abduction literature discusses in great detail.
The first group did someone at that meeting leak details of it? Is that how you come up with the five different crafts? And if so, how do we know what these people look like that came, if they weren't the Greys? Do we have any idea of that?
Sure, yes. Well, we have some descriptions. For example, we have a description by Commander Charles Suggs, who was with the U.S. Navy, and he described Eisenhower meeting these extraterrestrials that he described as tall, Nordic-looking, who discussed with Eisenhower those topics of interest, that Eisenhower was not allowed to actually physically touch or get too close to these extraterrestrials. There was some, I guess they must have had some kind of energy field that may have caused problems for Eisenhower. I mean, Eisenhower had a bad heart, so maybe that was part of it. But anyway, I mean, there was a description of Eisenhower meeting with these extraterrestrials by this Commander Suggs. There were also reports by individuals like John Lear, who undoubtedly got his information from his father, William Lear, who was very well connected with the senior officials within the Eisenhower administration and the Truman administration. Then you had whistleblowers like Bill Cooper, who claimed to have seen evidence of the meeting that occurred while he was serving on the briefing team of the commander of the Pacific Fleet. That he Cooper says he saw documents that discussed this meeting and went into detail about the different extraterrestrial races that that were involved. There's also a contractor by the name of Don Phillips, who worked who was part of the Disclosure Project, and he saw a film. I mean, he discussed a film of the meeting that he had witnessed. And so you have that kind of evidence of various whistleblowers either being physically present or having seen things like documents discussing the meetings or having seen films. So there's evidence that this meeting did in fact occur, and just privately in terms of my own research, speaking to a number of people who are very prominent in the Disclosure Project, I mean, what I've found is that all confirmed that meetings occurred. Now, what they weren't sure of were the dates. It appeared that there were a number of meetings throughout the 50s. So this was certainly, this February 20 meeting was definitely not the only meeting. There were many. But of one thing that is clear, that, you know, there's consensus within the at least those Disclosure witnesses that I've spoken to, who all confirmed that, yes, there were meetings, and that these meetings did lead to agreements between the Eisenhower administration and the visiting extraterrestrials.
And those would have been the Greys. And again, the supposition is that permission was given for them to land here, to base here, to abduct people. Probably was some caveat that they didn't kill people, but they certainly destroyed enough lives in the interim, do their research on them, whatever, and in return, we were allegedly given some advanced technology and knowledge, which may be involved in the Black Ops program that some suggest is so far ahead of the space shuttle, it's a joke, that there's a parallel program that has been going on for decades. It's hard to know, but we'll find out more about what Michael Sala thinks about that in just a couple of minutes. Exopolitics, is it a main factor in our way of life? It could be. Deal was made with one group at least. There are apparently many others who have come. One wonders about the first group that was not able to cut a deal, the so-called Nordics, Michael Sala, who look very much like us, but rather uniform in appearance, taller, I believe, but completely human. They went away empty-handed, it would seem.
Yes, that was a really interesting situation where it appeared that here's a race that is offering some knowledge in terms of the evolution of humanity as a species and how it relates to other human species in the galaxy, and that they were offering what we would consider to be wisdom, and they were offering that but on the condition that we cut back or just stop altogether the weapon systems that they considered to be most dangerous, and also that they viewed any technology that they had as something that was potentially going to be misused by humans who were still very immature in terms of their tendency to use things for weapons of war.
And we still are. So what we did, we rejected the high road and cut a deal with the low road.
That's basically what happened, yeah?
Might say that's the biggest sellout in human history.
Well, that's interesting you use that phrase, because if you look at who it was that was advising the Eisenhower administration, what you see was that there was interests there that were affiliated with what we would understand as being big business. And I mean, Eisenhower left is left at the end of his second term, warning about the military-industrial complex. And I think we can look at the rejection of the Nordics as being part of this early military-industrial complex being created, that even by the time of the Eisenhower administration, there had been, under Truman, a development of a vast infrastructure for black projects that would respond to the extraterrestrial presence. And with the Eisenhower administration, you had a Republican administration come in that was very heavily backed by corporate interests, and in particular the Rockefeller family were big supporters, and Nelson Rockefeller was actually Eisenhower's principal advisor on Cold War strategy, which was a euphemism for someone who would be advising him on how to deal with extraterrestrials. So here you have Eisenhower advising, you have Rockefeller advising Eisenhower on what was the best policy to deal with extraterrestrials. And so it's not surprising that they chose a policy that would basically be build bigger and better weapons, and corporations would be part of that whole process.
Is it all too fanciful for you to accept, or does it make sense? You have to make that decision. I'd urge you to read the book Exopolitics and study up on this, because there are a lot of indicators that overlay this perfectly. It's not just a wild shot in the dark. The idea that we cut a deal with the wrong group, and Eisenhower's very famous warning as he was leaving office, maybe his finest speech according to many, would have stemmed from having been overridden in 1954 by big business, big money, and all the rest of it. Now, what do we have to show for it since? An unlimited arms race, a world on the brink of utter destruction. And if this is true, and if the Greys are doing what we think they're doing, in other words, abducting people by the tens, if not hundreds of thousands, if not more, how many lives have been ruined, traumatized, maybe even lost to this? So what a deal it was.
Yes, it was an incredibly important deal.
You buy into it completely, right, Mike? You're not holding back. Michael Salas,
yes.
He signs on to this.
Yes, I mean, it all makes sense to me. The thing that really kind of really cements this as a part of the infrastructure of the international system is the black budget. And the black budget is really the way in which the whole infrastructure, the secret infrastructure, is funded. And the black budget is something you can actually find in the auditing practices of the various government agencies. And in particular, if you look at the auditing of the Department of Defense, you look at the budget, the yearly budget, and you find the funding irregularities on that, you get an idea of just how vast the black budget is. And all of this is done without congressional oversight. So that, to me, is evidence that while there is some purpose that is being served by this vast black budget. And
right. Hold on right there, Mike. We have to pause. We'll be back and pick up that thought in just a couple minutes. Exopolitics, how much of our lives here have been influenced by a deal made in 1954? It's hard to know. It's possible. And as Michael Sala puts it, it all falls into place. There's really nothing that doesn't fit. Is there, Michael?
No, I think everything is part of a kind of seamless web of managing an extraterrestrial presence that the government learned of back in the mid-40s and has continued to keep secret from the general public.
It is not to say that there is just one extraterrestrial type here on the planet. There are likely many types coming and going and so forth. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, definitely, and we can see evidence of that in the official documents that have been disclosed by whistleblowers such as Bob Dean, who was on the briefing team of the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe back in the 1960s. He saw a document called The Assessment, which basically went into the extraterrestrial threat to NATO forces, and he saw this document. His job was to brief the NATO commander, the chief NATO commander of all the European forces, on what threat the extraterrestrials posed. And he said that the document outlined four different races, at least four different races: the tall greys, the short greys, the Nordics, and also another race called the Reptilians. So this is in a NATO document that was disclosed by a whistleblower that had a long, distinguished career within the U.S. military.
He was a command sergeant major and was a guest on this program many times years ago and told that story in great detail. And it's a very interesting story. Bob Dean, indeed, was apparently privy to the highest level information you can get in terms of NATO. And the bottom line, as I remember Bob telling the story, was that the assessment was that there was no threat from any of these ETs because there was not a damn thing we could do about it. It was that simple.
Well, that's right. I think the whole idea of an invasion or a kind of military intervention by extraterrestrials, that really, when you look at it closely, just doesn't make sense, because we're talking about races who have been visiting the Earth for many hundreds and thousands of years. So if they wanted to invade and take over, that's something they could have done long ago. So what we're seeing is a presence that has a different purpose, something that we still haven't fully figured out, or at least the government hasn't fully figured out.
Okay. What else beyond the Eisenhower deal, which seems to be pivotal, certainly in the last half century at least, did you find or are you looking at to underwrite and support your thesis?
Well, a significant part of that was the way it was managed. I think when you look at the role of people like Henry Kissinger, Kissinger was someone that was formally involved in Project Paperclip. People aren't aware of that, but Kissinger was actually serving in the Army's Counterintelligence Corps in Germany during the Second World War and was part of the American team that was debriefing captured Nazi scientists and interviewing them for repatriation to the US. So Kissinger was aware of the extraterrestrial projects that the Nazis had sponsored. And so when he came back and got his PhD, and he eventually was introduced to Rockefeller, and Rockefeller was very impressed with Kissinger and basically recruited Kissinger to be a high-level consultant on how the extraterrestrial projects were to be managed. And I think Kissinger's approach to managing extraterrestrial presence was very much a power politics approach of basically trying to get as much as one could through making deals with whatever extraterrestrials were prepared to give technology, while at the same time building up your own military forces in case there was ever a military confrontation. So Kissinger was a critical political strategist for that policy that was introduced.
He's still going strong. Now, this whole thing would suggest that the deal is ongoing. And what about this parallel black ops program, which suggests that we have technology that is so far advanced from the space shuttle and NASA's traditional routine that it's a joke? And do you find anything to support that?
Well, yes. I mean, there have been many whistleblowers who have come forward and talked about such things as moon bases in the 60s and even a base on Mars in the 70s. That this is something that various whistleblowers or those involved in some of these operations have talked about. And we can even see it in the book of Philip Corso, who wrote The Day After Roswell, where he discusses a possible moon base. Now, he did it in a way where he left it as a hypothetical, but I think for anyone reading between the lines, I think what he was doing was basically saying that, well, this is what was built. So I think even in The Day After Roswell, you have evidence that there was a moon base developed using this technology. Then there's the underground technology, the vast high-speed rail system that's being developed that not only links the U.S. And all of the underground bases throughout the U.S., but also is global in nature. This global transit system, which uses magnetic levitation trains that travel at very high speeds.
Sounds like wonderful science fiction. What hard evidence did you find to support this? And this, by the way, is a program, an idea, a concept that we've talked about also for over 10 years on this program.
Sure. Well, there are various authors that have talked about it, and I'm sure you've probably spoken to Richard Sorda.
Oh, yeah.
And there's also the underground bases that have been described by various whistleblowers.
Well, one of the things, excuse me, Michael, that always pointed in that direction, and as you well know, the number of underground explosions and rumblings that are heard by people in various locations. Underground hums are also picked up in a number of spots around the country, which would suggest that underground tunnel boring is going on, and maybe then some. But maybe not all by us. Maybe it's being done by some of those people we cut the deal with. Well, about that in just a couple minutes. Okay, for many of you long-time listeners, you'll remember Richard Sauter's visits on the program years ago about his book, Underground Bases and Tunnels, and then he had another one after that. We're going to have Richard back on the program not too far down the road. And if you remember, some of you may even have his book, some of the photographs of tunnel boring machines from the 1970s were just mind-blowing. They're big as a railroad train, basically, and they move right into solid rock, and work their way through. But that's a long time ago in terms of technology. I wonder where they are now with it. It's probably come an awful long way. And the theory was that these machines, possibly nuclear-powered, possibly traditionally powered, can work right through all sorts of terrain underground and melt the rock around it as it passes through, and essentially leave a perfectly round, smooth, or relatively smooth tube behind it for transit. And, you know, it maybe make 100 feet a day, a couple hundred feet a day, I don't know. But when you extrapolate this over years, you can understand that there is, in all likelihood, a substantial, if not awesome, network of underground tunnels in various parts of the United States, if not covering the entire United States. We know the Germans built underground systems in the 1930s in eastern Germany and eventually in Poland that went hundreds of miles and with electrical rail transit underneath. Nobody knew about any of these things. To this day, most of them have not been explored. Several of them went underneath lakes and were intentionally flooded by the retreating Germans with apparently a lot of important material left behind underneath. So that's a whole issue that has only been talked about ever so slightly in history and in the current media as well. But yeah, underground bases, why not? That's the place to go. It's perfectly safe and the technology is there to do it. Michael?
Yes, well, those are underground bases are very significant because they are places where there have been lots of reports that these are joint cooperative ventures between extraterrestrials and U.S. national security agencies. And it's not only in the U.S., but also in other countries such as Australia. You actually have the Pine Gap facility there where you have something similar.
Right.
But in particular, there's a base at Dulce, New Mexico. Where
that remains a rumor, but it's one of those enigmatic things that that there's a lot of circumstantial evidence about.
Well, yes, there is quite a bit of evidence that Dulce is in existence.
There's something there, but nobody knows what for sure. And some of the fanciful tales of underground fighting with ETs and stuff kind of leaves some people cold. But yeah, there is evidence that something is going on there for sure.
Yes, and I think there's evidence that there's an underground system of bases in that whole southwest corner of the U.S., which is pretty pivotal to the whole infrastructure system that is in place for dealing with ETs.
Okay, well, where do we go from here? We have the underground tunnel system. We have a deal cut potentially with an ET race, which continues to abduct people and remove tissue and apparently try to develop some kind of hybridization process which leads to half and half or who knows what percentages. They're after something, whether it be genetic or hormonal or who knows what they're after, but something's going on. There was a trade-out made. How long will this go on? Who knows? Any guesses on it? Are they getting close to fruition on their plans? Will this go on indefinitely? What are your thoughts, Michael?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of evidence that the system is starting to open up, that people are getting the word. The information is not being suppressed as it once was, that there's fewer stories now of the kind of men in black who would harass witnesses or remove any evidence that people had provided for others. I mean, you have the internet now, which makes it makes it very difficult for the information to be suppressed. I mean, there are ways in which websites can be hacked and information removed.
Well, and the other way is, of course, to circulate disinformation to obscure and cloud the reality of things.
Well, yeah, yes, I think they've mastered that. I mean, that's an art form in itself, being able to get the researchers out there looking in the wrong areas and coming up with the wrong conclusions. So, but if any researcher does his job and does the cross-referencing, I mean, that's very important in this field. I mean, if you need to cross-reference. I mean, use as many sources as you can. If you just rely on one source, then you do open yourself up to that disinformation strategy. But if you have a few different sources, and there are a number of different ways you can get information these days, that helps to get confidence that, well, you've got a very reliable picture of what's happening.
What does your book say? Where do we go from here? What do you come to conclusions and projections that you might discuss briefly?
Sure. Well, basically, I think that what we need to look at is that the presence is something that has been secretly managed by national security agencies for well over 50 years now, that the whole idea of first contact has happened. I mean, that it's already a done deal. That as far as the general public is concerned, we need to look at other ways. We need to start working with those extraterrestrial groups that are willing to work with the general public, because I think it's wrong to assume that, well, because the government has a deal with extraterrestrials, well, that's it. Well, I mean, what they have a deal with are a particular faction of extraterrestrials. There are other extraterrestrials who are willing to work with the general public. I mean, there are numerous contact reports where individuals have been taken up and really given the information on what the those races described as Nordic or typically referred to as part of a galactic federation or some kind of association of like-minded human star nations, that these have knowledge to give, technologies that are environmentally friendly and very specific in their applications, that these can be developed and passed on to the general citizenry. So if that is something that people start doing more of, that if more people start developing their own connections with extraterrestrials on a kind of grassroots basis, well, then there's a way that people can circumvent the official system, which basically tries to monopolize all the information and all the technology to be gained from extraterrestrials.
Will there ever be any real trickle down from that advanced knowledge to us?
I don't think so. I think there's a trickle down to a certain extent. I mean, it's very slow. Philip Corso talks about it in his
Michael, excuse me. How much credibility do you place in Corso and his book?
Well,
it's clouded, as you know.
Well, I know that he is exactly what he claimed to be, that is, someone who worked in the technology division within the army, that he would have had access to technologies that were being developed by the military that were innovative or on that leading edge. And he was someone that developed a reputation. Now, I think when someone like that writes an autobiography that talks about their role in extraterrestrials,
mm-hmm.
well, I think you can assume that, well, you know, this is really someone kind of like laying out the cards, that you know, they're basically giving their story. I mean, he was fairly advanced when he wrote the book. I mean, I think he died just a few years after it appeared in press. So
right.
I mean, this was really his legacy. And so, you know, while certain parts of it might be attributed to an individual with a healthy ego, shall we say.
Or a ghostwriter.
Well, you know, that's also another possibility. But I think he gave interviews afterwards.
Oh yeah,
indicating that that the book was a fairly accurate description of
mm-hmm.
of what he had seen and what he knew. So
mm-hmm.
I personally place a lot of confidence that book is a pretty accurate description of at least what he experienced.
Right. Okay. Last question. Disclosure. To my way of thinking, there's no way to force disclosure. It's not going to happen. They will not let go of anything until they are good and ready to do so. Agree or disagree?
Yes, I think it really is difficult to force the government to disclose all of this technology based on the kind of arguments that people have been making, that it's the right thing to do or the moral thing to do or the constitutional thing to do. I don't think the government is persuaded by that at all. There need to be better reasons, and I think that the best reason is the strategic one, that that the best defense that we have against subversion of our nation or of the system on the planet by extraterrestrials is to have disclosure.
Okay, well, time will tell. Congratulations on the book, and thank you, Michael, for being here. It's a most interesting topic.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay. All right. Good night.
Good night.
Michael Sala, PhD, his book, Exopolitics, Political Implications of Extraterrestrial Presence. And there are a lot of reasons to take a good look at this book. All right. Be right back. Okay, this is going to be, you better sit down. This man is, he has more energy. If he could bottle, well, never mind. He wouldn't have to write any more books. He writes a book a month. They used to. Now he's sloughed off. Now it's every 4 or 5 months. He's been a friend, a colleague. He is a man that many of you know, you longtime listeners. He's remarkable. He has personally, I don't know what the numbers are anymore. I'm going to ask him in a minute, though. He's done regression therapy sessions on, it's over 10,000 different people. It's crazy. He has another new book out. It's called Past Lives, Future Lives. Yes, that's a familiar title. But Revealed is on the end of it now. It's a sequel in a way. Past Lives, Future Lives, Revealed. He is, of course, the eminently peripatetic, brilliant, erudite, ultra-sophisticated Dr. Bruce Goldberg. All right. Go ahead. Go on. Say something.
Yes. Good evening.
A profound response. Now he's got
to... Well, I thought I was paraplegic from your introduction.
Peripatetic. See, now what he's going to do, he's going to short answer me and make me sweat for an hour. To get
actually, for your information, the exact numbers are 35,000 regressions and progressions on 14,000 individuals for the last 3 years.
See? Well, I knew it was over 10,000 individuals, but that's amazing. You have no equal on the planet in this regard. I don't know of anyone who's even close.
Well, I appreciate it. I've been very, very conscientious, as they say, but the work ethic does pay off. But what's interesting more so than the numbers of regressions and progressions I've done is the fact that the most recent Gallup poll, which I do quote in the book, shows that 58% of Americans believe in reincarnation today.
Oh, really? What's the last reading before this one? Is it going up?
Well, back in the early, actually late 60s, it was like 20%. In 1981, mm-hmm. it was 23%. And then it hung around there until 1989, which is the last time they did this. And this was done by the Gallup people, and it was 58%. You could win the White House with those figures.
So in the White House is a lot lower than that. If you own the voting machine, you can win with 39.
So the key issue here is that Americans, which I think America itself is a fairly basically conservative, straight-laced country. I don't think we're ultra either way. But, most people believe, they don't talk about it because people will think they're weird if they do. They think they will anyway. But actually, there's a lot of closet parapsychologists out there. The reason I wrote Past Lives, Future Lives Revealed was not just to be interviewed by you again, by the way.
This is number 12,302, so we're closing in on that other figure.
But I like to think of this book as more like as an update, kind of like a summary, an overview of the field of not just my work, but the field of reincarnation and hypnosis mm-hmm. and regression and progression therapy. Because I cover here not only cases of taking people into past lives, and of course the field that I developed back in 1977 about taking people into future lives,
right.
but I also throw in a couple of other nice sections, one about psychic self-defense. There's a whole chapter on that.
Always an important one. That's one of my favorite areas with you. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a real biggie. It's one of the underrated aspects of metaphysics, I think, today. And the other aspect, of course, I throw in, of course, a case of a patient who wanted to perceive a future life, and I did, and we'll talk about him later, and he actually is going to be, in the 29th century, a time traveler who will come back in time and actually help assist history in its making and assist us in our own spiritual growth as well as our technological growth. At the same time, the big themes throughout the book, which I really put in the conclusion more, is the concept of the whole purpose of this is really prepping people for potential ascension mentality so they can actually grow spiritually and not have to come back and not have to read books like mine in their next life.
Right. Okay. Well, with all of the people you've talked to, 35,000, 14,000 individuals, are you seeing any trends? Now, I got a couple of specific questions for you, but have things changed in the last 3-4 years in any way? Are you getting different data? Has anything new
popped
up?
Well, interesting enough, regressions, more so with progressions than with regressions. Regressions basically don't change because that's history. You know?
That's right.
It doesn't matter when you do it. You go back to Atlantis or, the 13th
sure,
century BC,
sure.
you're going to get it. The future, however, the more I've done a lot more progressions over the last 10 years, and the future, contrary to a lot of people, is really positive out there, especially when you hit the 35th century, which is the big one, where, we had the greatest technological and spiritual growth aspect of humanity. So So I'm getting a lot of very, very nice positive things happening over the centuries.
That's 1,500 years from now.
Well, I'm talking about going all the way to the year 5,000. I mean, I'm talking, you know, for the next 3,000 years.
Right.
The next 25 to 50 years have their ups and downs, but the latter part of the century and beyond is really quite positive, quite productive.
Is that the, after we get past the angst, is that the beginning of the great period of peace and tranquility?
You don't have to worry about nuclear wars or things like that. What you do have to deal with are the things such as, on one level, politically, terrorist aspects, of course, and then you're also dealing with the things like, what I call the technological idiots out there, the computer crimes and people trying to, you know, do all kinds of things using high technology in their mentality.
But your future readings are not what you're saying. You're not showing a major catastrophe in the next 10 to 20 years.
Oh, no. But nothing that would be considered to be like millions of people dying or diseases or a major war that would be like a World War II or what people would think would be a World War II.
Now, let me ask you to factor in HIV/AIDS. Which has killed at least 50 to 60 million people in the last 20 years. That's a pretty big issue.
It's a pretty big issue, but AIDS and cancer are both going to be solved before the end of the century.
Well, you gave yourself 96 years.
But what you're not seeing is a geometric progression in the deaths, for example. Like Africa is a country that worries, or is a continent, if you will, that worries about AIDS more than America does. How many people in America die of AIDS per year compared to, say, places like Africa? Or
well, they're running 60% and 70% infection rates in some areas, so, yeah.
Okay. But it hasn't spread worldwide to a per capita, so you don't have the same ratios.
Right? Well, you know, it's not like Africa, but India has an enormous HIV/AIDS problem. So does South America. We don't hear about it, but they're there. Anyway, the point is, the data you're bringing back is from a future that doesn't seem to be as bad as what we look to be approaching as the world continues to arm itself with weapons of mass destruction to the left and to the right and everywhere else. So the big question, I guess, is how malleable is the future?
Oh, it's very malleable. In fact, what happens is you have to factor in the concept of also parallel universes and consciousness shift in here, in the sense that there are people out there in your listening audience who are extremely cynical and negative, and that's, they're welcome to their First Amendment rights. They will get a different future than you and I will get, or anybody else on a different mentality, because when you are focusing on a certain negative energy, you then go to that parallel universe where that negative energy manifests itself.
All right, so there may be cataclysmic wars and biological terrible events for those people who envision such.
Right, but the probability of them actually manifesting it is based upon where their energy is and a whole bunch of other quantum physics rules, which makes it really still less than tenable compared to what people think as a typical mentality. So even though there are potential parallel universes out there where things are very negative, it's still the odds of you getting it is still based on the universe's consciousness that we have today with all the people today, where we're going, and the future that most of my patients are perceiving is still positive.
For example,
I have patients who come from various walks of life, various cynicism, optimism, but they're all still, at least a great majority, are still reporting those positive futures. So you see on a representative sample, they're still all
That's interesting. That is very interesting. How, when you take someone, give me an average person, although there is no, they're all, everyone's different, but let's take someone into a session. How do we proceed, and how do you move them through progressive lives?
Well, what I would do is in a session, of course, depending on the patient's past experiences, if they're a novice, I take them through some various conditioning exercises, and we would do some, I might do a past life regression just to get them used to something they could relate to more than going into the future. And then I would take them into the future of this current life. We call this age progression. And then I would let them also see different parallel universes so they can see what different options are like in the current same time frame. We call those parallel universes or frequencies. And then I would just simply, the next step right then there is not complicate, take them right into the future. And, for example, here's a case, this is a case of a man named Mark, I call him in the book. He's a CPA. He's a very lonely, depressed person, very straight-laced, very conservative, but also just very, very just down. You know, his whole life has not been very productive. He's been isolated all his life.
Right.
He goes to a future life, and he His name is Elam. He's living in the 29th century in what we would call Greenland today. And he's a type 2 baby. Now, in the future, this particular, especially this particular part of the world, test tube babies were designed for a special skill. They were sort of like genetic engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But he winds up just an average person. Excuse me. He's living in an underwater city in Greenland.
Mm-hmm.
He's sent to the surface as a teenager because he's just simply, you know, whatever the experiment was, they failed, obviously. And then he becomes a co-pilot on a transport service that takes people from the moon, Earth to the moon, like it's a recreational area. His girlfriend, by the name of Zia, dislikes his job intensely because he's more like a party-on dude, you know. He's just kind of hanging out like a fraternity guy, and she wants him to be more responsible. She breaks up with him, and he now realizes, going through a lot of emotional toil, that his real hobby is inventing, and that his inventing natural skill was why he was genetically engineered. But because of the breakup with Zia, he has a nervous breakdown, and then he goes to an organization called TASC. It stands for Terrestrial Alliance for Scientific Knowledge, for therapy, the equivalent of psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
They cure him by the use of these color programming and music techniques in the future, which will be very big, mm-hmm. and he works for them as an inventor, using his skills sort of like as a payback, if you will. Now he gets married to Zia, everything is fine, and now, as Elam, now as the inventor working for TASC, he develops two inventions. One is a tele-immersion unit, which allows you to share the visual experience of another, regardless of the distance, so you can see the military applications, among others.
Right.
And then he develops something called a cyborg connector, which is a computer chip implanted in your head so data can be downloaded or uploaded to the brain via a small handheld computer.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of this, he feels good. He obviously enjoys the progressions, but his life and the current life changes, and he becomes more optimistic and begins dating and begins to have a life.
Wow, all right. Well, that's just another remarkable story. Past Lives, Future Lives, revealed by Dr. Bruce Goldberg. Just out in March of this year, 2004. Available for you right now, all the usual outlets, and we'll be right back with Bruce. Okay, and welcome back. Talking with Dr. Bruce Goldberg about his brand new book, Past Lives, Future Lives Revealed. How many books is it now, Bruce, altogether?
17.
Wow, okay.
See, one of the things I focus in as and basically just about most of my books, if not all of them, since my first one, and this one especially, too, is the concept of training people how to do what I call a super conscious mind tap. As easy and natural it is for people to get titillated about past and future lives, and they are interesting,
right.
But the key issue here is raising one's soul's energy, which is what I call a super conscious mind tap, is introducing the patient's subconscious mind, or soul, if you will, to their higher self, which we call the super conscious, which raises the quality of their soul's energy and allows them not only to overcome habits and phobias and to be all they can be, so to speak, but to also take charge of your life, and this is what I call the psychic empowerment part. Another advantage of these techniques and this therapy, I think, is one of the biggest things, is the idea of simply removing the fear of death. I mean, especially with middle-aged patients and older, this is a big thing. People are afraid of what's going to happen, and when they see a future life, not just the idea of reincarnation, like going into a past life and realizing there is maybe the possibility of reincarnation, but when you actually see your own future life, per se, what's going to happen, at least what the options are, you now have much more of a mindset of positivity and optimism rather than just crossing X's on a calendar and waiting for the Grim Reaper.
Now, the guy you talked about before the break and gave such a what a scenario that was, this guy didn't sound like the type that kind of material would come out of.
Even though he was interested in a future life because he had read several of my earlier books, he expected himself to be some sort of, you know, computer nerd.
Boring, yeah.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, so now is he Is he conscious and able to hear himself when he's delivering all this material, or is something you...
He'll have complete memories, too. Even though I'll tape a session for them,
he'll
have complete memories.
Right, so he's sitting there, and he's talking, and he has to be somewhat incredulous about what he's hearing in some portion of his consciousness.
Oh, yeah, I mean, especially, you understand, most people with regressions or progressions or both, they don't really get what they expect to get.
Right. So go ahead. Are you okay?
Yeah, I just had a little something went down my throat the wrong way. But
well, you're not supposed to eat and drink while you do radio programs.
I know, especially when water goes down the wrong pipe.
But that's right. See, okay. All right. All right, anyway, take your time. We have plenty of time. Have another drink.
Okay. But what I also do in this book, which, of course, has been characteristic of my others, is the idea of providing exercises for the readers, too.
Always it's something that Bruce Goldberg has generously shared with people, even on this program, and that's true. Self-help is something that he believes in, and he gives the most unique and amazing exercises, and they're all right there, and in this book, too.
This book has super conscious mind tap exercises, how you can access your higher self, exercises on regression, progression, mm-hmm. going forward in time, future life progression, accessing the Akashic records, if you will.
And you can do this all by yourself.
Oh, yeah, you can do this. You can. I always recommend people make tapes of it so they don't have to memorize scripts or pressure themselves. Or they can, of course, you know, I always have a series of tapes that people order from my website, et cetera, to make it professionally done with my voice on, so all the techniques are on there.
Right.
But they can do it themselves. Hypnosis is something that you don't want to put into a performance level. You want to make it as natural as possible, and you don't really have to memorize things. There is no magical one way of doing something. I just give like a nice formula or a nice, shall we say, spectrum or framework that works very successfully, and obviously over the last 30 years for me, and make it easily accessible so people can do it and then modify to their own personal taste.
Right. All right. Okay. Got it. All right. So how long does a session like that take with the gentleman you did describe? An hour? Does the material just come out, or do you have to kind of help him, wait for a few minutes, a little bit more? Or is it just, you're so good at what you do, does it just pour out if you dial in the right frequency?
Well, every person has their own level of hypnosis. Now, Mark was, I would say, an average light, medium-level hypnotic patient. He's characteristic of probably 70% of the population.
Yeah.
So in an hour-and-a-half session, which is what that particular progression was, done in, if you will,
mm-hmm.
in that hour-and-a-half session, you know, he was able to get all that information and actually more. We actually did more things there. That was just the actual gut of the session. There was also some conditioning and some age progressions prior to that particular session that all occurred in the same hour and a half.
Well, what did he say when you brought him out of it and he realized what had been produced?
He just simply said, I'm amazed, I'm shocked, and I'd like to think about this and discuss this for a few minutes. And of course, he did.
Yeah, I should say so. And he's probably listened to that tape a dozen times since then. Okay, hold on. Be right back with Dr. Bruce Goldberg in just a couple of minutes. His brand new book is, again, just out for you, Past Lives, Future Lives Revealed. Okay, Past Lives, Future Lives Revealed with Dr. Bruce Goldberg. The book is available. I want to be sure I catch this right. The book is available, Bruce. Where?
All over the world.
Okay, that's what I thought.
In the fifth dimension.
The usual distribution.
Yes, the usual distribution. It's a brand new release, but it's actually been out for about the past month. It should be all distributed now so they can get it anywhere,
yes.
Amazon's and all the bookstores.
Mm-hmm. Still smoke coming off of it after a month.
One thing, just for your listeners too, as you know, I do, when I travel, I do workshops and I do experiential workshops on these techniques. And for your Canadian listeners, I'll be in Vancouver, BC, and Edmonton and Calgary in May and June, and Toronto in mid-June also. So if they check my website, all the travel instructions and all the workshop information is on
there.
And
just click on Bruce's name at rents.com and go right to his website.
And if they need to the URL, it's DR, that's D as in David, R as in Robert, and then spell Bruce Goldberg, BRUCEGOLDBERG.com. And all the information is on there, including the book link, of course, has all the descriptions of the new book as well as all the other books I have. And if your listeners don't have a computer for some unknown reason, they can call my 1-800-KARMA-4-U, 1-800-KARMA, the number 4, the letter U, which is 800-527-6248.
Good, wonderful phone number. I'll never forget that.
It came to me one time, and the phone company was cooperative.
Now, couple of years ago, you were on, and you and I hope I'm not prying here, but you had found your soulmate.
Mm-hmm.
And
she's still here.
Okay. All I wanted to know.
Michelle is her name, by the way. She's my lovely soulmate. She met her 4 years ago. We celebrated our fourth anniversary in February.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of the techniques that I use in myself, if you will, for myself, as well as what I train my patients to use. And this is part of the Super Conscious Mind Tap.
Yes.
In fact, I have what I call an entire tape program on my site called the Ideal Relationship Program, which this is part of. It's called Find Your Ideal Relationship, which is actually your soulmate. And what you do is you, by raising your own subconscious mind, let's call the quality of your soul, the frequency
right.
vibrational raise, as we call it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that, of course, solves a lot of problems. It helps you to overcome habits and phobias, be more empowered and confident, and what I call psychically empowered.
Right.
But what you're doing now is you're sending out a signal, just like
transmitter.
A signal.
Transmitter.
That's right. And then guess what? The person that would be your soulmate, whoever that person is, will now be in a receptive mode to receive that signal. And no matter where you are, because Michelle was over 1,000 miles from me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When I met her in Seattle, you will actually, the universe, via both your signals being honed together,
mm-hmm.
will work it out so that you guys will meet and you guys will relate. So if I can do it, anyone can do it. The kind of crazy life I live with my work schedule and,
yeah.
you know, the kind of things I do.
Remember when I told you to go to Seattle?
Yes, yes, I do, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, okay.
Seems like you're pathetic. You're the Nostradamus of...
I'm pathetic? What was that?
So pathetic.
Now watch it.
Just like me being paraplegic, right?
That's right. Okay.
Okay, but one of the cases, but this is a fun case, but this is a case that I think is kind of the culmination, if you will, of the case that I put in the book. And this is a man who came to me, his name is John, and he was, you know, just a regular, nothing fancy about this guy, he's a regular guy, and he wanted to perceive a future life.
Mm-hmm.
And he becomes a man who lives in the 35th century. His name is Kamar, K-A-M-A-R, and he is actually a time traveler. He is actually a time traveler. Now, he gave me a lot of details about the training of time travelers, which makes this case rather fascinating.
Hmm.
Time travel will be discovered in about the year 3050, okay? So this is 400 and plus years before he's born.
Mm-hmm.
But the place where time travel is actually perfected is the risen continent of Mu, or Lemuria, in the Pacific Ocean.
It comes back.
And it comes back, it rises, and around the 28th century or so, and by the year 3050, it is now the seat of it's equivalent to the NASA Lyndon B. Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. It's a movie. It's on this, like, big continent island, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
He's a chrononaut. That's what a time traveler is, and he must go through three different phases for his training. He has to have a doctorate in hyperspace physics to be eligible for this program. He has to be trained in what's called quantum medicine, which is the future medicine using energy healing. He has to know the history and archaeology, of course. When he goes back in time, he's got to be able to relate to the people, and et cetera.
He has to have read all of your books, too.
That's right, yes. He's got to be physically conditioned. Now, it's not as relevant in the 35th century when teleportation is there. Before teleportation is discovered, of course, they have the equivalent of the G factor, so they have to be very in very good shape. And then they also have a third phase, which is the spiritual growth component. They have to know things like chakra balancing, hypnosis, and other methods to help people and themselves and their own teammates, if you will, in the spiritual growth capacity. But what's interesting about Kmart's life is not just his 35th century experience, but something called the Electric Wars. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with these. The Electric Wars were a name given to wars between ET groups, various ET groups throughout our history, going all the way up to about 1500 BC. Kmart was sent back to about 100,000 BC in Lemuria, which is Mu, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and he was involved with trying to help prevent these the two major groups that were fighting were the Lyrians and the Syrians. The Lyrians were the bad guys, the Syrians were more of the spiritual ones, so shall we say more on our side.
Mm-hmm.
And these electric wars were more than just electric wars with technology. They were a form of brainwashing, actually. What happened was that you had something called impulse codes. This was the Lyrians were trying to do a form of genetic manipulation, which manifested as a three-dimensional distortion of reality on unsuspecting humans. Even without conscious awareness or permission, this technique is coded into the memory so that past experiences can be wiped out and brainwashing scenarios substituted. It's more than just hallucinations. It's an actual genetic DNA alteration of the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is Kmart with his group as time travelers were assisted by two ET groups who were dimensional travelers. One were called the Atheans, who looked like praying mantises, and the other were the Ranthia, that were sort of like shape-shifting, non-matter-based ETs that assisted in helping resolve this war and actually keep peace on our planet.
Okay, and all this just comes pouring out of Bruce's patience. It's just amazing. And we'll be back with more in just a few minutes. Say the least, there are some more here. One of them, of course, touches on The Search for Grace, that wonderful CBS movie of the week that was based on the most documented case of reincarnation ever. Tell us a little bit more about that. There are some younger listeners out there, Bruce, who don't know about that.
Well, The Search for Grace was about a woman, I call her Ivy. She was obsessively attracted to a man who literally tried to murder her on three different occasions in her current life.
Right.
Now, in her past life, in past lives, I should say, we did 46 of them. In 20 of her 46 past lives that we elicited, she was murdered by the same man, we'll call him Johnny, and she just simply could not get away from the concept of being killed by him. And remember, this is the same guy who reincarnated with her in her current life who was still trying to kill her. And so she was able to go through her most recent life, which was one of a woman named Grace Doze, who lived in Buffalo, New York in 1927 and was murdered on May 17th of that year. And this was a case that she gave me about two dozen facts which were verifiable. This was turned over to CBS's researcher. About 22 of the 24 facts corroborated, but two did not. The name of the age that she said she was 2 years older than the newspapers reported, and the name of her son was different. As it turns out, the newspapers were wrong, and she was correct.
Wow.
And she couldn't have known that because in New York, unlike California,
mm-hmm.
You cannot get into the state's records, into the health records, without the governor's permission, or a paper trail has to be established. And nobody between 1927 and 1992, when CBS did the original research,
mm-hmm.
No one had requested that, so she couldn't have known because she wasn't a member of the family and had no way
wow.
of knowing this.
This is an amazing story, incredible story.
Well, it's a case of documentation, which doesn't prove anything. It gives highly suggestive evidence. It's a great case. But what I think is even more fun is, on a more esoteric level, is the light people cases.
Okay.
And here's a case of a man named Ed, I call him. He becomes what we call a light people planner. Now, light people go back many, many millions of years, and these are beings from...
They were the first folks around, weren't they?
Yeah, this is the beginning of the karmic cycle, literally. This name, Ed, actually, he becomes a planner, and he's evaluating this entity known as XL-47, who does well on the Earth, inhabiting a human body, if you will, and is promoted. Meanwhile, there's this entity named MR-62 who fails his test and now is going to be condemned to be stuck in the physical body, i.e. the karmic cycle. And the reason MR-62 failed because he had too much food and sex and was too obsessed with his life. Does that sound familiar in our plan today? Light people actually come to our planet to facilitate our evolution, and they inhabited the bodies of primitive humans while altering genetic coding and other biological processes to help assist us in our development. Unfortunately, many of them got carried away, and they got stuck in the karmic cycle, if you will. When these planners are evaluating these entities, their colleagues, they use a room which is a fifth-dimensional room. It's not like what we would call a room today. It's more of an energy point with swirling lights, most of which are white, but many colors are present, and there are black voids in the room which function as entry and exit points. And these light people communicate entirely by telepathy. They're not time travelers. Remember, this is way back in time now. And they're not from the future. They're from way back in time. They're from another galaxy. They function on a different dimension, the fifth dimension, if you will, and the only thing that can confine a light person is magnetic fields and thought patterns. They have a hierarchy. They have planners, and they have what's called master planners, and they have different light colors symbolizing their rank. Their frequency, vibration, rate is determined by the various rainbow colors of the spectrum. So the light people are not just strange and unusual as a sci-fi thing, but they also, I think, represent the actual beginning of our karmic cycle.
Interesting. Well, maybe so. Maybe so. I'm still intrigued with the idea that people would sit down and then step outside of their normal shell and begin to detail these future lives that are so explicit and so, well, they're sophisticated descriptions of a very different kind of life. And I don't suppose you could ever be fooled by anyone, not after all your experience, but where do these people get, where else would they get this information?
Well, you know, when I wrote my first book, Past Life Future Lives, I described the case of a woman who described the case of a 39th century futuristic woman on a different part of the galaxy and all this kind of thing. And
yeah.
This was a Baltimore housewife. She was, with all due respect, she was a good old redneck, okay? I mean,
right.
She was just a uneducated, nice, sweet woman. I really liked her. She was a very sweet woman. But she had, she wasn't intelligent. She wasn't...
I gotcha.
Right? She didn't have any vocabulary, per se. And she's sitting there talking about biotelemetry experiments and all this sci-fi stuff. And she wasn't into sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
And, she just, sat home and watched TV and whatever with her husband. And
mm-hmm.
So these kinds of things are also give it a little bit more credibility. The skills that people distribute or exhibit, if you will, when they do these past and future things are also something that are beyond their usual range. So this gives a lot of additional
mm-hmm.
credibility
mm-hmm.
to it. And I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm using it as a therapy orientation. But again, the media, of course, and more skeptics in the scientific community, they like, of course, to see the documentation. So this becomes more relevant when you do that. Going into the future, of course, is always the fun part because there you can actually test it for the veracity and find out whether something comes true. I mean, I believe we've mentioned this before, but just as a quick survey, in 1898, I put this in the book, a man named Morgan Robinson wrote a book called Futility about a supposedly unsinkable ocean liner, an iceberg.
Yeah.
Maiden voyage, carrying the lead of society of two continents to their deaths. He described the Titanic almost exactly with the number of passengers. It was 800 feet long, weighing 70,000 tons,
right.
A few light boats. This was a man named Morgan Robinson. No one's heard of his name. I guarantee you, your audience, no one's ever heard of this guy. He wasn't a famous, not like Mark Twain.
No.
But his book, Futility, didn't do real well in 1898, but in 1912, when the Titanic went down, all of a sudden people started doing some homework. And they found out that this guy, obviously this guy saw into the future. I mean, this was intimate details of what occurred just exactly 14 years to the day. I mean, Jules Verne, when he wrote From Earth to the Moon, he described the details of the Apollo 11 flight in July 1969. The initial breakaway velocity of Jules Verne's craft was 36,000 feet per second. The third stage velocity of the Apollo 11 was 35,533 feet per second. I mean,
right.
these things are amazing,
Yeah.
So you're getting things to show you that there is And, of course, quantum physics, if you will, does show that the space-time continuum exists as it is, so that there is no such thing as the past or the future. It's all occurring right now. We're just reading the monitors, so to speak.
Interesting image.
The other thing is that dreams are also, this is for your listeners too, dreams will often precede both past and future life experiences. And even various parallel universe experiences that come up too during these sessions. So when people have these dreams of ancient Egypt or Rome, it's not just watching a movie or something they think they're just casually interested in because of the civilization itself. If you're getting a lot of commonalities over and over again, especially repeated dreams, you're likely to get some sneak previews or surveys or summaries of actually past or future life experiences, especially death experiences. In fact, I think most of the causes of phobias today are actually due to the remnants, if you will, of past life death experiences.
Oh?
Oh, yes, especially drownings and...
Well, we've talked about that, but, I mean, that holds stable all the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can tell because I can tell people who have, let's say, acrophobia, fear of heights, and they'll describe several past lives in which they were either thrown from a cliff or, you know, fell out of an old plane, maybe 1920 or something, or something happened where it's over and over again, and it's not just once, whereas they'll die in other lives just one different, you know, one way in a certain way, but not a consistent pattern. The pattern is the one that carries over.
How close to the future are you able to get? Can you go a couple of years ahead in somebody's life, or do you like to take it full lifetime at a time?
Well, you can go a few hours. I mean, I've taken patients. I told you about the famous Tammy case about the woman who perceived herself going on TWA Flight 800 and changed her flight. She went forward in time by about 3 weeks. Scenario. I've taken patients literally forward in time just by a matter of a day. Some people want to perceive how a meeting is going to come out or a date, if you will, or some other situation that's important to their personal or professional life so they can lay out the scenario and fend off potential obstacles in any particular goal.
But with different potentials in the future, it doesn't always have to be that way.
But you can be, but of course, I also trained them in what's called the new U technique, where they actually train themselves to stay on that same frequency. So they can actually be all they can be and get what their future perceives not just as an option, but actually make it a reality.
That's right. And we've talked about that in the past, too.
Right. That's called the new U technique, and that's actually an age progression technique. But that's also part of this. I mean, so you can do anything. The nice thing about this is that it's like one size fits all here.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you can harm yourself. Hypnosis is something we go through every day for 7 hours a day, 3 hours of dreams, and 4 hours of daytime daydreams. People listening to your show can be in hypnosis at least 25% to 30% of the time. Watching TV.
Well, especially listening to your mellifluous voice.
Prophetic sometimes. It's natural, so all I'm doing is using the application, the A word for application, simply applying a very natural state of mind for people to use therapeutically so they can literally take charge of their life, and this is where the psychic empowerment comes in.
More in the book, Past Lives, Future Lives Revealed, a woman who overcame her sexual dysfunction after learning about her past life as an Amazon.
Yes.
A nymphomaniac's past life as a ceremonial dancer in a primitive Polynesian society.
These are very detailed lives. These regressions are actually very detailed, and it's kind of like it would take like about, you know, about 4 or 5 minutes to describe each of them.
Yes.
They're very detailed, and they're very, very emotionally productive in the sense that you can see when you read the actual scripts, because they put the transcripts of each of those cases in there, when you see what the patient has gone through, as traumatic as some of these may have been, but of course they're perfectly safe, and then they rise above it, but they find out all the details about, of course, their current boyfriend or an ex-lover who is an enemy now, was, of course, a bad guy in the past life. You can see the patterns repeating themselves over and over again.
That tends to be true, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Those are called karmic scripting, if you will, and the karmic paybacks and karmic relationships. Or we call this group karma. And you will, if you either have love or hate for someone, you can guarantee you're going to have a life with them again.
Unless you let that go.
Well, unless you resolve it and rise above it, of course, right?
Well, okay. Congratulations on another new one, Bruce. Always fun to talk to you, and I appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Jeff. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, too.
Thank you. Take good care.
You too, now. Bye.
Okay. Dr. Bruce Goldberg, Past Lives, Future Lives Revealed. His website is drbrucegoldberg.com. And you can click on his name and go right to it if you'd like to. All right, we'll pause, and we'll be back in 21 hours.